Thank you, Soan, for inviting me. I have done a lot of Zen training too, so it feels very familiar. Probably one point, maybe 35, 40 session with Suzaki Roshi. We passed away a few years ago at like 103, 104. And also a number of sessions with Sungsan Sonsonim, the Korean Zen teacher. And then since most recently, when I lived up in Nevada City, practiced at Ring of Bone Zendo with Aiken Roshi, passed away, and Nelson Foster. So I'm kind of eclectic in that sense. So it took Jukai both with Suzaki Roshi and Aiken Roshi, in addition to my Vajrayana approach. Also have done major part of my training with some very well-known Nyingma, or old school ancient ones of Tibet. So in the majority of my training been of course in Buddha's Dharma, but time-wise maybe half Zen. Actually, kind of, my Tibetan teachers kind of said, well, okay, we'll let you study Zen. But sitting, that's good. Sitting's good. You know, I was saying that. That's good. So, in the Gelug tradition, scholarship and meditation go together. So, talk's going to be somewhat scholarly. So we cite our sources, say, what are we talking from? So that's always really traditional. We hear talk from the Dalai Lama. He'll say, this is the text we're talking from, and this is where this came from, and la, 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 like that. We are connected, Alliance or through Sarajay Monastery in southern India. I've been a monk and lived in India at Sarajay. So they still consider me, Sarajay alumni, I guess. We regularly have visits from the abbot. I think we're on our fourth abbot now visiting. So lines are, I've tried to maintain a strong connection with my teachers and with the Asian tradition, both Mongolian and Tibetan. As people know, that can be very, like having one foot on the dock, one foot in a rowboat, right? Keeping those two together. But I've been very committed to that, like that. I'm not primarily theologically oriented, although I've done all the graduate work and everything that my tradition has asked to me to, but I'm apparently maybe just fell in love with my teachers, right? It wasn't even like I gotta be Buddhist or something, or this is right and I've checked out the other religions, they're wrong. It's just I met Trungpa Rinpoche, it was just, you know, connection, and then had connection with my other teachers. So it wasn't that I went looking for like this is the right way to believe first. It was more kind of personal connection like that. So today, forgiveness is the topic. Something like that. We're not going to cover it all, okay? So, like that. So, I also have a full-time wellness clinic, licensed psychotherapist, practicing 25 years now. I'm able to accomplish everything at Lion's Roar because I have an incredibly dedicated staff. incredibly dedicated students. Otherwise, I couldn't do it. But in talking about forgiveness tonight, I'm going to draw from or criticize or comment on psychological approaches to forgiveness. Then there's like religious Christian ideas of forgiveness, and then there's American and traditional Asian ideas like that. Cover it, try to cover it, right? I'll start out with inspiration from an article in Tricycle magazine. People know him. Ken MacLeod is a well-known Buddhist teacher. He doesn't call himself Lama, but he's done 2 3-year retreats back-to-back. Counts for something. So Ken, who I know and have had at my center in Nevada City when we were there, I'll just read from his article so you'll get Ken. I don't know, anybody know Ken MacLeod? Yeah, so let me say, this is Ken, right from the start, I am not going to be diplomatic. The extent to which the notion of forgiveness has insinuated itself into contemporary Buddhist thinking disturbs me deeply. Although many may disagree with me, I feel that current interpretations of forgiveness in the Buddhist community undermine the teachings of karma, encourage the cult of victimhood, weaken human relationships, and obfuscate the practice of purification. That's Ken. Like that. Yeah. within the Vajrayana tradition, I don't say Tibetan because Vajrayana is, of course, in India, in Mongolia, Bhutan, Sikkim, Tibet, now United States. Ken is right on. There is no forgiveness. We don't talk about forgiveness. The practice is a purification practice. In classical Buddha Dharma, at least classical, when we say going back to Nalanda, Nalanda is the monastery in India that primarily sent most of the people to Tibet, and that Dalai Lama is connected with. We're connected with. You can't forgive other people. In the sense, just like you can't take away their karma, the Buddha cannot, I don't know, am I knocking it? The Buddha cannot change your karma, cannot step in and change your karma. The Buddha, there's a famous phrase, the Buddha does not transfer realizations. The Buddha does not wash away sins with water. The Buddha does not cure by healing out of hands. The Buddhas just teach. So very technically, the forgiveness model that most of us inherited through Judeo-Christian model isn't present in Buddhism. I was also a religion major, Phi Beta Kappa at Middlebury College, and took 4 years of Latin. So that's true. It's our forgiveness, the way we use the term, is through our Judeo-Christian tradition. You know, I grant you forgiveness, or God forgives us, and then the debt is paid, right? We can't do that in Buddhism. Classical Buddhism, you don't do that. If you injure me, and I'm upset about it, I'm not going to ask, I'm not going to forgive you. I'm going to do practices to purify, relieve my own anger or grief or betrayal or something like that. I'm not going to ask you to forgive me. In a practice that I'll introduce and talk about in a minute, in Vajrasattva practice, from our side, if we injure someone, we're going to do purification practice and we're going to apologize and make amends. But we're not going to ask for forgiveness. This is really classical Nalanda Vajrayana Tibetan Dharma, like that, actually. I'll talk about Vajrasattva in a minute, but I just love Ken. It's just like, forget it, guys. No. You know, it feels like some movie, right, with Clint Eastwood or Unforgiven. Something. Forget it, won't work, can't forgive. So that viewpoint is not shared by some contemporary Buddhist teachers like, you know, Jack Kornfield, everyone knows, right? And I downloaded Ken's articles from Tricycle Winter of this year, and Tricycle, I don't know when this came out, Tricycle has an ebook, right, on forgiveness. So if you join Tricycle and donate, you can download it. So it has teachings by a few teachers I heard, haven't seen, Achan Sumedho, Matthew Flickstein, Bob Thurman, Mark Epstein, Jack, Thich Nhat Hanh, Gina Sharp. People know these people? Yeah. Where they're all talking about forgiveness, mostly using the metta practices of developing friendliness. We don't have the Metta Sutra and Vajrayana, but we do have Maitreya practice. But historically, the Metta Sutra wasn't about forgiveness as much as fear, right? Monks and nuns walking into it didn't want to be bitten by snakes, so, which is still the case. So be nice, extend loving kindness, but not so much forgiveness. Am I fading in and out, or no? Okay. Nice article about Angulimala by Thich Nhat Hanh from Old Path White Clouds. So if you're interested, this is, you know, a lot of material. It's good. Then in my psychotherapy practice, I recommend this famous book, Fred Luskin. I think he spoke at Google, right? You know, sorry, Apple. Is that right? Apple, yeah. So maybe Google too is famous. Forgive for Good, right? Fred. Book of Forgiving, Desmond Tutu. Can't go wrong, right? Okay. So this is very religious. Yeah. He's bishop. Okay. This is cognitive behavioral psychology, right? And then we have American Buddhism. Like, you know, kind of American Buddhism blending of, Jack Kornfield style, I guess. I don't know, something. Spirit rock style. And then you have the hardliners, like Ken. I think Ken's a very forgiving person, I should say. He's good fun. But I want people to be aware that there's a wide range of approaches, right? So traditionally, as Lama, I will tell people, you don't have to forgive your abuser. You have to work on your own side, but you don't. Our tradition does not require you to forgive your, you know, someone that's wronged you. Some people find that very relieving, like, oh, wow, I had to purify mind and somehow I had to forgive them. Even when forgiveness isn't defined as condoning or accepting or forgetting, it can be very hard to forgive. So in our tradition, it's kind of a relief. You don't have to purify your mind and you don't have to forgive. You can still wish, as part of your bodhisattva training, that they be liberated, but you don't have to forgive them. It's a little different distinction, right? So, like, last night, Charlie Manson died, right? Okay. The credit score for the galaxy went up about 100 points, you know? Not nice person, right? So the people and families that were affected by, call him Charlie, they don't have to, from our side, in the Vajrayana tradition, they don't have to forgive. They don't have to say, you know. But we want to purify from our own side if we're carrying anger, resentment, or misknowledge. So we do our practice, and we may do our bodhisattva practice saying, you know, may you be reborn in a better state and liberated, mainly because we don't want you coming back for another round, right? But we don't have to take the extra step of forgiving. For many people, forgiving is an obstacle. Even though they say, I know I'm not condoning, I know I'm not forgetting, I know I'm not lightening, but it's an obstacle. I see Charlie because one of the psychiatrists who worked with him in Vacaville when he was at the medical center is a friend of mine. And Charlie almost escaped from the Vacaville medical facility. I got to tell these little stories. the bars, but the bars are on windows, and what the inmates did, this one with Charlie, you know, but others, they put toothpaste on their dental floss, and over the year they could saw through the bars. And then they would, you know, kind of fill it with glue or bubble gum or something. So, and then at the right time they would take the sheath. They actually did that. But Charlie didn't do that. Charlie got through there, because I used to volunteer out at Folsom Prison, both of them. Charlie got through 3 checkpoints. He almost walked out. You know how I did it? He just told people, like, I've been released. And they said, okay, Charlie, good, all right, hey, nice, thanks, you know. They didn't think he, you know, it wasn't like he was totally released from prison, but, you know, he was released from the medical facility. So it wasn't until he got to the outside pod, this kind of a health pod in Vacaville where they take him back to Corcoran or wherever it was, that somebody says, hey, we got Charlie here, and no one seems to come to pick him up, you know, what's going on? It's amazing, right? So, in Buddha Dharma, we recognize in Indian Tibetan tradition, Vajrayana tradition, you know, that there's some nasty people, so we don't have to forgive them, but we don't want to be carrying them around either. And we do want them to be liberated. And in fact, it's possible, okay, so Charlie dies, and goes into what we call bardo intermediate state and sees the clear light. And guess what? He could be totally realized light right now. Would that be okay with you guys? Or do you really do we want to forgive him but, you know, still kind of just have a little bit of a rough time? Okay. So in our tradition too, you know, if we're talking about forgiveness, if we're talking about working with bodhicitta, the desire to have other beings free and happy as well as ourselves, we kind of do these mind experiments. You know, like, that would be a hard one. You know, I noticed just personally, I just like Charlie to have a little bit of a rough time before he goes to a pure land or is liberated, but I still don't want him coming back. But let's say he totally became awakened and bodhisattva, would we want him back? Possible, you know. So that's why it's important to read the story of Angulimala that is in the biography by Thich Nhat Hanh, Old Path, White Clouds, which I highly recommend. Because Angulimala was kind of the Charlie Manson of the day, or, you know, and then unbelievable, right? Just switched. Do you think we could handle that? That'd be difficult, right? I'd find it really hard. The practice that we do in Vajrayana is called Vajrasattva practice. And Vajrasattva practice is about a meditation to return and recognize the natural purity of our mind already. No mistakes in it. So we do the Brahma Vihara practice, the four immeasurables, and we develop bodhicitta. People know that term, the spirit of awakening, of course. And of course, Brahma Vihara is compassion and, you know, love and joy and equanimity. But when we really have to return to our original nature, to use kind of Zen term, we do what's called Vajrasattva practice. And you have a lot of nice tankas here, but not Vajrasattva. You have Shakyamuni and Manjushri, Bhava Chakra, yeah. Tara. So in the Vajrasattva practice, we have the R's. I'm just going to teach it a little bit. Is that okay? People interested? A little bit. So Vajrasattva means indestructible being or diamond-like being. So we first recognize, we recognize our innate purity, and then we recognize we're off balance. So, you know, in our tradition, particularly when we're practicing Dzogchen or Mahamudra, you always recognize your Buddha nature first. So I have to train people when they come to darshan and interview with me. This is not therapy. You don't start with, guess what happened to me this week? You start with, this is my realization of Buddha nature. This is my experience. Or at least, I know I have it. I don't know where it is right now. It's somewhere around here. You always start with your open awareness. And then from there, you say, you know, this or that is out of balance with me. Then we do purification mantra. Then we do another R called regret. Regret is, it's regret. You know, like, wow, I wish I hadn't done that. Kind of like that, regret. But in our tradition, after regret comes remorse. So regret's kind of like politicians get sometimes caught, or recently, you know, Harvey gets caught. That's regret, right? Okay, sorry I got caught. But we have to move to what's called remorse. Remorse is, I'm just going to read in our text. This is very kind of Western style. My heart aches as I see clearly through what I have done, betraying those virtues I hold most closely to my heart. I do not want to abide in this misstep. I cannot walk this path that causes sorrow any further. So remorse is a real, you know, like kind of crying state where, you know, to say, well, I made a mistake and I'm sorry I get caught, but I won't do any. But, you know, there's some kind of inner change going on there, values-wise. It's at that point that we then take refuge. So refuge is, practice of, three jewels. Everyone knows refuge, kind of, right? Maybe not. We do tantric refuge here. You know, we take refuge in the dakas and dakinis and lamas and heroes and heroines and the bodhisattvas and the lama and vajrasattva. You know, it's a very extensive support system. Then we generate bodhicitta, the wish for enlightenment. Then what's interesting is in tantra style, we, particularly if we've had the initiation, the teaching, the permission, the empowerment, we become and visualize ourselves as the Buddha Vajrasattva. So you don't just stay in your ordinary mind or body, you transform into the Buddha Deva, the Buddha deity. This is very unique to Tantra. Although in Zen, you know, like when I was doing koan work with Sasaki Roshi, you know, he would say stuff like, you know, how does Bodhidharma sip tea, you know, like that. You know, so you'd be asked to become the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, the something like that in koan practice. Then another R, you know, we do a lot of this visualization, so you really feel like you're a Buddha. That's the idea. Sometimes we say in recovery, you fake it till you make it, but actually we're not faking it. we're being it until you get it. That's important, okay? So that's a long story, but we do a lot of practice for that, and then we do the remedy. So it's funny, you become Vajrasattva, but the remedy becomes a long mantra recitation. So it's interesting, the remedy is you proclaim your awareness. You don't just kind of go, well, I guess I'm a good person. We do that sometimes. Oh, I know I'm a good person, but don't make me say it. But in Vajrayana, one reason we call it lion's roar is we proclaim our Buddha nature. We just kind of say it. So that's the mantra. Should I do the mantra for you? People know Vajrasattva mantra? I think I should take this off. It's the long one, but it will go fast. Do you know the long one? Oh, cool.
It's been years.
My attendants brought my bell, so nice. Just so you know, it's like, it's funny, like, when Lama's teaching, you think that Dorje would go on the right, but actually, in the Lama's phone, it goes over here. So that's what Vajrasattva says. In Sanskrit, actually.
Is that a public recitation or private, or does it matter?
Public, you mean like you could just kind of do that downtown? Yeah, you could do it. Yeah, you do it. Yeah, you'd all do it. You do it all together. You could do it together.
Oh, I see. It's part of the service.
It could be part of a service, yeah, that's true. So that's the remedy. And then, can you still hear? Like, okay. Then, we have confirmation of the purification. And it's funny, even though we're Vajrasattva, the other Vajrasattva says, oh, child of good family, your negativities and obscurations and damaged and broken pledges are cleansed and purified. You're restored to your pure Buddha nature. So then, that's long meditation. And then we make a resolve. This is the fun part in Vajrayana. We're saying we're not going to be off balance again. But you can say, I'm never going to do this again. Or you could say, I'm not going to do it for one day. Or 1 hour, 1 minute, or at least a few seconds. Okay? So it's very big in our tradition. We don't say, I'm never going to get angry again. I've said that before, and has anybody else said that? And then, yeah. So, I don't know why. I think one of the hardest thing, it's fairly easy not to be kind of greedy, I think, isn't it? Grossly greedy. It's okay not to be, it's easy fairly, to live a simple life, right? And it's comparatively easy. I know this sounds, I shouldn't say easy, but a little hard to work, but not impossible to become, have some realization. We've got good teachings. We should realize nature mind, right? Our Buddha nature. It's very difficult, however, not to become angry from time to time. Do you agree? Really, So one of my teachers, Jadgud Rinpoche, used to come visit at Lion's Roar, and I have the good karma. I just get to know people personally, So he brought his wife, Jane Trumge, now Trumge Kondro, and we're just talking, and I said, what's? I'm saying this. I'm still a therapist, so I say to Jane, What do you think the biggest challenge in your relationship is? And what I loved about Rinpoche, who's got a great book, is he said, the biggest challenge is my anger. This is an important Rinpoche. This is like unbelievable. He wrote an autobiography too, and I just have to explain what an incredible teacher is. Like, he left Tibet, stayed in the West, 40 years, and was able to get back into Eastern Tibet to see his original teacher, who then was elderly. And when he got back there, he brought back Jane and his son Jigme Rinpoche, so forth, trekked into Eastern Tibet, high plateau, kind of grasslands like Mongolia. And then he heard his teacher was on retreat. He wanted to see his old teacher. He can't believe it. What's that like? So finally, I'm alive. I found Dharma, founded Dharma centers in the West. Here's my wife, kids, blah, blah. So his teacher was on retreat, but he got permission. You send your attendant up. The person says, okay, I'll see Rinpoche. He goes up there, and his teacher, said, oh, good to see you. Great. This is lovely. And like in 10 minutes, said, I got to get back to my practice. And in the autobiography, Rinpoche said, it was just incredible. I was flabbergasted. He got kind of pissed. Like, WTF, I traveled for weeks and I haven't seen you for 40 years. And like, seriously? So, yeah, but the teacher was serious. Like, I'm going back into session at 5 o'clock and it is now, 5:05. So we're wrapping it up. That's incredible. Rinpoche kind of digesting, like, okay, like that. But, it's incredibly difficult to deal with anger, So as my students know, anybody that says, I've attained patience will be challenged, right? Even if you don't say that. So you don't even have to challenge me. I get pissed all the time, so you don't even have to try very hard. But in Vajrayana practice, I bring this up, that our primary thing that we're purifying, or kind of Judeo-Christian sense forgiving, is working with our anger and our rage. So in Vajrayana, that's kind of more destructive than pride, or more destructive than jealousy, more destructive than desire. It's the rage, right? That does the most harm, because it can undercut everything immediately. So that's when we're looking for purification, or we'd say another, using the term forgiveness as kind of a gloss, it's usually for anger. Usually we don't apologize and say, I was really being greedy. We usually have to say, oh, sorry, I lost my temper. Isn't that so? No. So we then do our resolve, we do our repair, we actually do amends, like almost like 12-step. And then we return. So the Vajrasattva, we dissolve as Vajrasattva and go into, it's kind of funny, it's not technical, go into emptiness, and then we come back as just regular Nirmanakaya, like this, right? And then we rest. And rest in us means resting in nature, mind, like resting in natural state, you know, say Mahamudra, Dzogchen style. And then we dedicate. So that's a very elaborate, that's how we do our forgiveness thing. We don't call it forgiveness, we call it purification, because we do it all from our side. I want to stop here, you know, and take some questions, comments, complaints, see if you can piss me off. So on this, please.
Okay. The thing that leapt into my mind at the beginning of your talk was the murders in Charleston a couple of years ago, and how the families of the people who were murdered, like within a day of the murders, were publicly saying, they were publicly expressing forgiveness for the man that committed the murders, and it was I have to say, just honestly, it was almost as shocking as the murders. It seemed to me, just where it hit my heart, it seemed way too early for that, for a human heart to turn around that fast. I could see it happening over a process or something, but it was just yeah, I don't know. It just seemed like there was some some teaching, I guess, that had been deeply absorbed, that this was the way to respond. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have any comment about that, but it still flabbergasts me that that could be kind of it seems what do you call it, bypassing something. You know, it seems to bypass a certain process that human beings have to go through to reach, if there's going to be forgiveness. It seems like we don't go there that fast. So I don't know. I'm not blaming those people for forgiving, but it was just so, I don't know, I still can't understand it.
Yeah, I think you know, understanding how forgiveness is used within that tradition. You see, that's very contextualized in a way. You know, that it had to mean a way that they move forward in that way. Buddha Dharma contextualizes certain things too. My first counseling job actually was at Catholic Charities in 1982, worked with refugees from the Khmer Rouge killing fields, okay? So some people are pretty damaged. Some people are kind of okay, you know? Like, get to know their story. So I'm always interested to still ask the question, like, how did you get through all of this? And a traditional Buddhist approach, and these are very traditional Cambodian Buddhists, some of them would say, well, it was our karma that happened. And, you know, from psychotherapy point of view, Judeo-Christian point of view, you'd go, that's crazy, don't say that. You know, it's like, you know, don't da-da-da-da-da. But see, that's so Buddhist. Classically, like, well, I'm you know, that's on my karma. And if I'm pissed about it, upset, confused, traumatized, that's all about me. Which is really kind of, in a way, as fantastic as saying, you know, just right away, we forgive you, you know, because that, you know, I'm saying, really, you know, you didn't have to do a little stuff around that too, you know. But the story we tell ourselves is enormously important. How we frame what's happened is enormously important. And that's what interests me a lot, is how different religious traditions, psychological traditions, people, you know, frame their story. And some of it is spiritual override or denial, and some of it is just, oh, well, you know, I'm okay, that happened. So I've worked with many people who said, you know, that was, you know, God has a plan, that was part of the plan, they're in heaven, and I'm okay. And they are okay. That's the interesting thing. Some people say it because they feel they should be saying it, right? But they're really not okay. So as a therapist and lama, I do want to cut through the shoulds behind it. Like, I should forgive people, or I should be okay with that. Because that generally will perpetuate it. But there are some people who just said, well, you know, that was the plan, or that happened. I grew up in New York and knew families and knew people with tattoos on their arms, and people from New York would know what that means. And some people would go, well, that was then, and that's now, and I'm, you know, raising kids. And it's amazing. I'd say, well, how do you do that? Yes?
I was just going to share with you, I studied with a Nyingma Dzogchen teacher for 20 years in a community, and after the 20 years, it came out that there had been abuse, widespread abuse. And I had deep grief because that abuse was connected with the Dharma. And I kind of wandered around and talked to Vipassana teachers. For 7 years, I did Vipassana practice. And it wasn't until one of them suggested that I practice forgiveness for him and for myself, for giving away. I was a confused young woman. So I think your point is well taken, that it really, you know, it depends on the time and the place and the circumstance as far as what we can apply as a remedy. Because finally, that practice of forgiveness put to rest any resentment I had or anger towards him, and allowed me to turn towards eventually Zen. I found a home in Zen, which was just sitting. Because, you know, I'd done visualization and nandro practices. And I really like being reminded of all the different approaches that fit for different people who really long to awaken to their true nature.
Thank you. That's really the point of my talk. The forgiveness for me is contextual in a way. So I really believe Buddha Dharma, you know, everything Buddha said or teachers say is to a specific people or to person at a specific time in a specific place, you see. So in a sense, it's hard to universalize things, you know. So you know, appreciate those comments. Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
A comment and a question.
Yeah, sure.
The comment has to do with a story I've heard. Thank you. And I think it was a story that the Buddha told about a fellow rowing a boat, and another boat comes and hits him, and anger naturally flares up. Why don't you watch where you're going?
Yeah.
And he turns around and he sees that the boat that hit him is empty. It was just adrift, and the anger evaporates.
So I've just found that a really useful story because it does seem to me that there's always, everything has a cause, and if you understand the causes, then it's harder to be angry if you fully understand. Yeah. The question is about a confusion I have between purification, the Vajrayana way,
yeah,
and forgiveness. It's hard for me to distinguish. I can understand Erzat's forgiveness.
Yeah.
You know, sort of, it's the should thing to do, but doesn't purification result in forgiveness, and doesn't forgiveness require purification?
Yeah, that's a good question. So somebody in the Valley Stream Sangha will have to pick that up as the next topic, you know. But I forgive you, you know, kind of in semantics and philosophy as a performative utterance. A performative utterance is when somebody in authority or somebody that feels something true says it, just saying it makes it true. You know, the standard thing is if you're minister or priest or something, you say, now you're married, then you're married as a result of saying the words. So there are many performative utterances in Vajrayana too, like, you know, like mantra is a performative utterance in a sense. So how I'm interpreting that is that purification, you know, which really means just returning to the natural state, and in our tradition doesn't mean bad, good, it just means using that way. But it takes some kind of performative utterance. You see, you have to do, you can say, well, I am Vajrasattva, everything's clean and pure, but then you have to say it. You know, you have to say, you know, I have to do the mantra, you have to say, make the resolve. Yeah, so that has a performative utterance, just like, you know, I'm forgiving. So there's something about saying it out loud, you know, just like in 12-step, you know, you say it in front of, you know, someone or your sponsor or not or something. There's something about it, we have to say it out loud. That's why we have ceremonies too, you know, like to just say it out loud. So I think there's power in the act, you know, what we call the act of forgiveness, the act of acknowledging nature, mind, the act of Sansanim used to say, press the clear button.
It's a social utterance, a social event?
I think lots of times it is a social event. It definitely, you know, some people are very social. They have to say it first before they hear it internally. You know, maybe more extroverts, and then some people are very internal, you know, because many times abusers or events, you know, have passed and we can't say it to them personally, so we have to say it to ourselves. Or we're forgiving ourselves, or, you know, we're saying it to ourselves. You know, so there's a Zen koan, maybe from Blue Cliff or Mumon Khan, you know, where the master says, never be deceived. Okay, I'll never be deceived. You know that one? You know, so that it's kind of like that. You know, you have to, you know, talk to God. So that dialogue nature of mind is really important. And that, for me, is the strength of psychotherapy and the Middle Eastern traditions. Sometimes, you know, where you can talk to God. So sometimes Buddhists get a little bit too materialistic and think, okay, well, I can't talk to my Buddha nature. But if you're talking, your Buddha nature is talking, and something's listening, right? There's something going on there. We're able to do that. So this is not dualistic. Dualistic is thinking you can't do it. Dualistic interdependence is you can talk to yourself.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So you could substitute the word the unconscious for Buddha nature in that sentence, and it would still make sense?
You know, kind of When you say unkind, does it mean like kind of Jungian style, like very deep, yeah, like that, you could, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so, I don't know, we're getting, it's 8:50, so, should we close? One more comment, question, last minute, gotta say? No? Did we do it?
One more.
Okay, one more. Yeah. Is that we're go ahead. Yeah.
So I was wondering if you could just give me a little feedback. I work in the field of addiction recovery.
Uh-huh.
And obviously a big part of addiction recovery is you're dealing with somebody who's been who's experienced trauma, and there's pain there, and there's attachment there.
Yeah.
So a lot of people would say, well, you need to forgive so that you can move out of that. But what does that mean? Forgiveness means a lot of different things.
Right,
probably.
Right.
So just in a quick nutshell, I say three things, and I'd like, just from a Buddhist teacher standpoint, like, are any of these, like, not in alignment?
Okay.
So, number one, I say, move into acceptance. It happened. Number two is, don't personalize it. Don't own it. It's not who you are. Stay aligned with who you are. And number three is, don't attach yourself to it. Move away from it. Use it as a launching pad, not as a sticking point.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we could be, you know, expressing that through, you know, Dharma kind of style, for sure. Like in this talk, I'm very much interested in the process of purification and forgiveness rather than, you know, when I read a lot of Buddhist literature, psychological literature, Christian literature, it's kind of, they're homilies, right? Here's how you should forgive. You know, we're within the moral universe of, this would be good for you to forgive, and I'm sorry you're in pain or they're in pain, you should forgive, you know? So when you read a lot of religious literature, Buddhist or psychological, it's, you know, stories, and here's the benefits of forgiving and so forth, which I think are all good, but I'm interested in how the process of forgiving works. You see, I'm giving kind of scholarly thing, you know, back behind. Like, why does some, you know, what works for really people? And for me, that's part of the Bodhisattva training, like having different tools in the toolbox, like, forgiving doesn't work, use mindfulness. If mindful doesn't work, you know, use something else, right? So, you know, we can use different paths, but what do they all have in common that helps someone release from their anger, from the guilt, or from their need for revenge, right? Or feeling like a victim. So I'm very interested in that. Yeah. That was just one more.
Okay.
Oh, all right. That's it. And then we're done.
Okay, thank you, Lamala, by the way. So basically you're saying, rather than giving advice like, oh, well, don't feel this way or don't think this way, it's more like, okay, this is the process to get through it.
Yeah. On a weekly basis, I work with folks who've endured horrible situations and have since working with Cambodian refugees. And I never want to presume to tell someone how to forgive or work through their trauma. I'm always going to keep asking them to, like, what keeps you going? What do you think you need to do now? Or I'll feedback to them, like, I noticed you were able to do this, or I noticed you want to stay on that situation, right? So I'm you know, my students are used to saying, I will never push someone off the diving board. Some people want to be pushed, right? Like, just push me into enlightenment, push me into forgiveness, nudge me. And I frickin' won't do it, okay? I won't do that. Don't go to I'm just saying, don't be with teachers that are going to push you off the diving board, because one, it's a violation, and two, you won't get the feeling of jump. You want the feeling of jump, like that kind of lift, and there's something special in that, right? But it's hard. It's a longer process when you're kind of going, well, try this out. Tell me what you're feeling and moving forward. So even though we do give normative prescriptions for this would be good for you, I recognize that everyone is going to take what they need and hopefully leave the rest. Just like tonight. Hopefully everyone's gotten some benefit. If you haven't, please forgive me. I'll deal with it. No, I'll deal with it from my side. That's okay. You don't have to forgive me. Just kidding. Okay. All right, okay. I love being here. Thank you so much. So we need to do closing prayers, right? Yeah.